This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, November 12th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Sam Houghton, and Daniel Ackerman. We'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. We'll check in with Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. CAI's Patrick Flannery and Mike Dean will be talking about all the news from the State House, and we'll hear from CAI's Eve Zukoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The COVID vaccination effort for children 5 to 11 years old got underway this past week after approval for the pediatric vaccine came late last week. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has been following the story and joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Great to be here, Steve.
Jeanette, tell us about the rollout of the vaccine for kids in our region here. Where are parents heading to get it?
Well, there are a variety of places. Pediatricians are starting to hold their own clinics for patients. Some pharmacy locations have it, but not all. South Coast Health has held clinics for children at the former Vanity Fair outlet in Dartmouth. And on the islands, both hospitals are booking appointments online. School clinics are starting also. On the Cape, those are being coordinated through Barnstable County. And the Barnstable County Health Department also has its own clinics on Thursdays at the county complex.
Overall, this seems to be a fairly smooth rollout so far. So many places you're listing here. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, there are a lot of options starting to open up. I mean, it's not that there hasn't been some frustration, I'm sure, from parents if they're looking for an appointment that's kind of like in town, close to them, or on a particular day or time slot. They may be finding it's not as convenient as they had hoped. But, you know, as time goes on, more and more of these clinics are starting to open. So you'll probably have an easier time and find something closer to home in the coming couple of weeks than before.
We're going to stick with some COVID news here at the top. Barnstable County enacted a COVID vaccine mandate for county employees this week. CAI Sam Houghton has the details. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
And tell us about the mandate itself. What does it call for?
Yeah, so if you're one of the 240 or so Barnstable County staffers, you'll have to be vaccinated against COVID or be subject to regular testing. That means a negative PCR test that has to be presented every Monday morning. If you don't present that test, you'll be suspended for 5 days without pay. And if you don't have a test the following week, the policy says you'll be considered to have abandoned your post. The commissioners have been talking about this for a few months now, and Wednesday it finally was voted through. It's going to be implemented the Monday after Thanksgiving, so commissioners wanted to get this through before the holidays, and they have. Chairman Ron Bergstrom has been the loudest proponent of this mandate, and he's been unapologetic in trying to get this passed. His opinion on the matter is that the only way we're going to get out of this pandemic is, you know, to get everyone vaccinated, and there should be no excuses.
And now, in the end, this passed on a 2-1 vote, but even that one no vote wasn't really opposed to the mandate itself, right?
Yeah.
In fact, all the commissioners agreed that there should be some kind of mandate here.
Yeah, fair to say. Yeah, at least they didn't argue against the mandate. The discussion this week was really mostly about language. I thought it was an interesting discussion. So the county administrators that came up with the policy actually made a more simplified mandate than the state and federal ones. They didn't mention any rights or exemptions, whether religious or health related. They said, you know, whether a personal decision or religious, staff could choose to get tested rather than vaccinated, and that would clear their hands of any work trying to determine, you know, what's a valid excuse and what isn't. Bergstrom, he originally came out against this in general, this idea. He thought it was too soft. They shouldn't allow anyone to get an exemption, except maybe in a health-related issue. He eventually came around to the idea, realizing it could be a lot of work for staff just to go through all, you know, these exemptions. The actual no vote was Mark Forrest. He wanted the exemptions to be noted in the policy, like the state and federal mandates. He said, like, you know, the American Disabilities Act and Civil Rights Act that allows people to make exemptions. But it passed anyways. We haven't heard much opposition to it yet. This is so new, except we did hear from, you know, former Commissioner Ron Beatty, a household name around the Cape. He says if he were elected, he'd try to rescind this mandate. He wrote that on Twitter and then tweeted that he's considering another run.
Mm. We learned this week about a COVID outbreak at the Bristol County House of Corrections in Dartmouth. CAI's Daniel Ackerman covers the South Coast. He broke this story. He joins us now. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Steve.
What do we know here? How widespread was this outbreak, or is it, within the jail? And what happens when an incarcerated person tests positive?
Well, as of Wednesday, which was the last time I was able to get numbers, there were 29 incarcerated people who had tested positive, plus three corrections officers. So the sheriff's office told me that the positive tests started trickling in a couple weeks ago, and then a bunch came in over last weekend. So 13 of those 19 positives happened over last weekend alone. And a spokesperson for the sheriff said anyone who tests positive gets placed into medical isolation. So they basically are moved to a cell by themselves. Previously, some people were staying in cells with one other person. There was also a group area, basically a gymnasium with a lot of cots where a lot of people were staying together in the same area. So anyone who tests positive or who is contacted with someone who tests positive is put into medical isolation.
And do we know?
Another thing.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Another thing that I heard from the sheriff's office is that they routinely offer a vaccine to anyone coming into the jail. But I did talk to one attorney, Ben Evans, whose client is currently in the jail there in Dartmouth. And Evans told me his client had asked corrections officers for a vaccine about 3 weeks ago. So this was before the outbreak started. But as of this week, he still has yet to receive it.
And what do we know about the severity of these illnesses? Have there been any hospitalizations?
So that is information I'm still working to nail down. The sheriff's office told me that nobody has had severe symptoms and nobody has needed hospitalization due to COVID. But yesterday I did speak with the mother and the wife of a man who was in the prison. He was there awaiting a court date. And they told me that last week he fell ill, he was lightheaded and he fainted a couple times. And he was brought to the ICU at St. Luke's Hospital. And I couldn't confirm whether he was one of those 29 people who tested positive for COVID in the jail. But his family members both believe that that is the case. And they said that he has an underlying respiratory condition that could make those COVID symptoms more severe for him. So I'm still trying to get more details on the severity of some of these cases. But one last thing to note is that this is not the first significant COVID outbreak at the Bristol County House of Corrections. During an outbreak last year, more than 40 incarcerated people and more than 40 staff members tested positive.
Also this week, the first public comment session was held in the Federal Environmental Review of Mayflower Wind. And that would be the state's second offshore wind project after Vineyard Wind. Jeanette Barnes, you covered this. Tell us, what was this meeting like?
Well, compared to some of the other offshore wind meetings I've been to over the years, it was pretty quiet. There was a presentation about Mayflower Wind by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and a representative of Mayflower. That lasted about an hour. Then they had a public comment session for people to enter comments into the official record. About 9 people had pre-registered to do that, to make those comments, but only 4 actually did so, gave the comments at the meeting. And then there was a question and answer session at the end, but questions had to be submitted in writing, so people weren't sort of questioning them live.
So you say it was comparatively quiet. Tell us, what kinds of things did regulators hear from the public who did speak?
The main themes, I would say, were fishing concerns, jobs, and the concern for the ocean environment. A clam industry representative was there, David Wallace. He said the one nautical mile distance between turbines is unsafe in all but the most, for fishing boats. That distance, though, has already been approved for the first Massachusetts wind farm, Vineyard Wind. So it's kind of hard to know if there's any appetite really on the part of regulators to make a larger distance for this second project, Mayflower Wind. Another questioner said that, and he was a local person here, he said that he had some professional knowledge of energy transmission, and he was worried that the line carrying the cables underneath the seabed would have oil in it that could leak into the ocean. But actually Jennifer Miller of BOEM said that that's not an issue for Mayflower Wind at all, because she says those lines actually do not contain any oil.
Mm. There are more of these public comment sessions coming up that people can sign up to speak at?
Yes, there are two more, both over Zoom, next week on Monday and Thursday. The story on our website has a link to that, to the Zoom registration. And people can also comment in writing, and we have a link to that as well in our web story about the hearing.
Hmm. The Cape Cod Canal bridges the Bourne and the Sagamore may be one step closer to being replaced. Sam Houghton, you spoke with the region's congressional representative, who told you the new federal infrastructure bill has money for this big project.
Yes, Bill Keating, he was quite confident that the project would get funding from this bill. The federal infrastructure bill is $1 trillion. About $9 billion is going to Massachusetts. And a little over $1 billion of that is going to bridge projects in the state. Keating says the Bourne and Sagamore bridge replacement is unique in that the federal government is on the hook for paying for it. He says there's actually what he called statutory language to that extent. So he's confident that the infrastructure funds will go to this. This is a big deal because there hasn't been a source of funding for the bridges yet. So we'll see how much these projects get. The replacements are expected to cost about $1 billion, and then the road work to connect to the new bridges are expected to be about another $1 billion, so $2 billion in total there. Interesting, though, the state yesterday announced a round of public meetings on the project that will start next week. We haven't heard much bridge news recently, so it looks like things are starting to move again.
This massive infrastructure bill we're talking about, it wasn't just about roads and bridges. Keating says there's some other stuff that he calls critical for our region in that bill.
Yeah, I mean, maybe more expensive than these bridges are wastewater sewer projects that are going on around the Cape. You look at Barnstable, their project's expected to be more than $1 billion. Mashpee just voted to approve about $50 million in funding for part of their sewer project. Then you have PFAS contamination issues we've been talking all about around the issue, around the region, on the islands, South Coast, and the Cape. So there's about $1 billion going to the state for these water projects. There's also funding for climate change kind of resilience, things like dredging, sand replenishment projects, huge issues for many coastal communities. There's also funding for things like electric car charging stations, improvements at airports, and improvements for better broadband service. So there's a lot to it. Keating says that this is one of the most or the most important bill he's ever voted on in his decade as a congressional representative for the region. Just for a little politics here, if you can indulge me, some high profile progressives in the House didn't vote for this bill because it took away their leverage to pass kind of a massive social package. And I talked to Keating about that. He did vote in favor, obviously, of this infrastructure bill, and he says he'll take up that social safety net soon. He says that could be even more important, so more to come on this story, I think.
And when you talked to him, he was actually in Scotland at
that
moment.
Yes, in Glasgow at the climate change conference, so he was representing one of the committees that he sits on.
Hmm. Daniel Ackerman, you covered a legislative hearing this week about redrawing the state's congressional districts. Tell us why that hearing was so important to the South Coast.
Yeah, so the legislature, they redraw the congressional map for the state every 10 years after the U.S. Census. And last week, lawmakers released a proposed map for what the state's 9 congressional districts could look like for the next decade. And broadly, this map looks pretty similar to the map we've had previously since 2010. But there was some contention over where exactly the district boundaries fall on the South Coast. So in this proposed map, the region's biggest cities, that's Fall River and New Bedford, are separated into two different districts. So Fall River would join the fourth district, currently represented by Jake Auchincloss, and New Bedford would remain in the ninth district, represented by Bill Keating. And so this hearing was for the legislature to gather feedback on that proposed map. It lasted more than 5 hours. People testified via Zoom to explain whether they supported the proposed map or whether they wanted it changed to unite both of those South Coast cities into one district.
Well, tell us a little bit more about who testified and what did they have to say?
All right, so I guess to start with the supporters of the proposed map, most people who testified in support of this map came from the Fall River area. That included like local elected officials and business leaders. And many of them liked the idea that under this proposal, Fall River would become the biggest city by population in the fourth district. So one person who testified was State Representative Carol Fiola. And she also said that keeping these two cities in separate districts, you know, meant Fall River could have a lot of, you know, a lot of sway within its district. And then also that the South Coast overall would have the strength of two advocates at the federal level in Congress. Now, there was about an equal number of people who testified against the proposed map. And that included Congressman Bill Keating, New Bedford Mayor John Mitchell, former Congressman Joe Kennedy testified. And they basically argued that two representatives is not better than one for the South Coast. They said that Fall River and New Bedford share a common culture. They share economic interests, especially surrounding the marine economy. And the two cities also have high populations of immigrants and people of color. And so they argued that uniting these two cities into one district would ensure that their elected congressperson actually comes from and understands those communities of Fall River and New Bedford. And basically they pointed to the fact that currently with the cities in separate districts, Fall River's representative lives in Brookline, like a wealthy Boston suburb, and New Bedford's rep lives in Bourne, which they say has more in common with Cape Cod than the South Coast. So at this point, the legislature's redistricting committee is going to consider all this feedback, and you know, we'll see in the weeks to come whether they choose to ratify the map as proposed or shift around those boundaries and unite the South Coast cities.
Daniel, before I let you go, one more thing. We got a little bit of news this week about refugee resettlement in New Bedford. Briefly, tell us what you learned.
Yeah, well, the first family of Afghan refugees to resettle in New Bedford arrived yesterday. So it's a family of four with two children. And the Immigrant Assistance Center in New Bedford has been working to help with the resettlement. I spoke with their director, Helena Da Silva Hughes, and she told me it's taken the better part of 2 months to find housing for the family. That has really been the biggest challenge, just finding places for these families to live. But she said they found two apartments, so another family will be arriving tomorrow. And basically more families will arrive in the coming weeks as more housing becomes available.
That is CAI's Daniel Ackerman. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks, Steve.
And CAI's Sam Houghton and Jeanette Barnes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. How do you replace a senior center in the town of Chatham with a new, bigger one? Seems like it should be a straightforward problem to solve. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to explain why it's not so easy. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, if we had a nickel for every time we talked about this story on the Roundup over the last few years, it feels like we could probably have paid for a new senior center for Chatham or something close. This has been going on for a while.
Yeah, you could say this story has legs. it's actually been about a decade that this has been under consideration by the town here. The senior center sort of took a back seat while other facility buildings were built, such as the fire department. But in the last 2 years, this has become a priority for many in town. But in June, a proposal went before town meeting for a $8 million senior center in West Chatham. After months and months of discussions and meetings, this was the design and location that was settled on. But the funding for that failed by 98 votes. It disappointed quite a lot of people. And this week,
it got a majority. I'm sorry, it got a majority, just to explain, but it didn't get the two-thirds majority it needed. Is that right?
Exactly.
Because
the money was going to be borrowed, it required a two-thirds majority of town meeting voters to pass, and it fell short by 98 votes. So there was a lot of disappointment in the senior community. Senior advocates in town have been talking about how poor and inadequate the current senior center is, which on Stony Hill Road. It's too small. It's an old facility, and some seniors have called it an embarrassment to the town, given that Chatham has one of the higher percentages of senior citizens of any Cape town, really. Orleans, I think, is the only one with a bigger percentage. So the selectmen had vowed to continue looking into what could be done about a new senior center. And this past Tuesday, the board held a public forum to gather input about where the situation should go from here. Basically, those at the forum said, we want a new senior center. We want to keep going and figure out how we can do this. There was really no disagreement that it was needed, but there was quite a lot of different opinions and division on what should happen, where the senior center should be located. Specifically was one issue that divided a lot of people. Some continued to advocate for the West Chatham location on Route 28. Others thought that the current senior center could be demolished and a new facility built in its place. And still others want to add on to the community center near downtown, basically building a senior wing onto that. That idea was rejected by the selectmen in favor of the Route 28 site because on Tuesday, Park and Rec Commission Chair Meredith Fry continued to oppose using the community center property, saying that it'd take away outdoor space used during the summer rec programs and would make an already difficult traffic situation worse. If you know the location, the community center is right near the downtown Rotary in Chatham. And in the summer, traffic regularly backs up there. And it would really make adding more traffic to that area would not be a good situation, a lot of people felt. So the way it was left on Tuesday was that public comments will be sort of cataloged and compiled into a report, and the Board of Selectmen and the Council on Aging will sit down together with that report and figure out what their next move is going to be. If you still are interested in commenting on that, comments are still being accepted through 5 p.m. tonight through the town's website.
It's an impressive discourse that they really have taken in here. They've listened to so many different opinions and be curious to see how they try to move this forward. That's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
For people living on the Outer Cape, finding a doctor has become next to impossible. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent has this story. He joins us now. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
Ed, your story has some excruciating personal stories of people trying to get an appointment to see a doctor. There just aren't enough providers, it seems, and the providers who are there are just overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's a very important story for our Outer Cape towns. When we were getting ready to launch the Independent more than 2 years ago, we spent time talking to people out here about what they wanted in their local newspaper. And one of the main things people said was to explore the issues of access to health care. And it's gotten significantly worse over the last couple of years. Outer Cape Health Services is the only provider between Eastham and Provincetown, and their 200 employees, which include 20 primary care doctors and physician assistants, are simply overwhelmed. So Pat Nadel, the CEO of Outer Cape, told us that it's now 6 months wait to get to see a doctor if you're a new patient. And at the same time, we have quite a few people moving out here. You know, the census showed us that the population of our towns has increased quite dramatically, and a lot of people are relocating here from the city for different reasons, often because, you know, they love how beautiful and remote it is. Well, that remoteness is one of the problems recruiting people, professionals, to work out here.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. It sounds like a number of primary care physicians have retired in the last little period of time, and that has also left people without doctors. And then to get new doctors to come to the region is very difficult, in large part because of housing issues.
Yeah, it's Darren Tangeman, who recently moved from Colorado to the Outer Cape to become the town manager in Truro, and who it took him 9 months to get a doctor's appointment at Outer Cape. He said there's a trifecta of problems here. One is housing. Two is compensation, that salaries for jobs out here are low. And the third is health care, it's very difficult to attract professionals here because of the lack of primary care doctors. And this is a national problem. It's not just a problem at Outer Cape Health Services. Medical students do not want to become primary care physicians because they can make twice as much money or more becoming specialists. And at the same time, the demographics of the Outer Cape and the whole Cape really are that people are older. Older patients generally require more appointments and more attention and care. So the few primary care physicians and physician assistants that we have are just overwhelmed, and more of them are retiring. Another one, Dr. Kim Mead Walters, who's been practicing for 26 years in Orleans, is about to retire and turn over her patient load.
Ed, let me jump in the minute we have left. Tell us a little bit about what efforts are underway to try to address this on the Outer Cape.
Well, Outer Cape does have one advantage, and that is that because Outer Cape Health Services is a federally qualified health center, it can offer loan forgiveness to doctors and physician assistants to have their medical school and training debt forgiven. And that has helped with recruiting and retaining some providers. And they're doing everything they can, really, to recruit people. They advertise. They offer bonuses for signing, relocation, and retention. I don't know really what else they can do. I think that this is a problem that needs to be addressed on a systemic level.
Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Steve.
It is scallop season on Nantucket. This year has brought an unexpected sign for optimism when it comes to the future of scalloping on the island. Josh Bowling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror has this story and more. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, tell us about this discovery that was made recently.
Sure, and it is a sign of optimism. It's a good thing, too, because the current scalloping season so far, that's about 2.5 weeks old, has been pretty dismal so far. Even the most experienced and veteran scallopers are not finding too many scallops out there. So what was found was a huge bed of scallop seed, which are immature juvenile scallops, just off the island's west end. Town shellfish biologist Tara Riley said she's never seen anything like it in all of her years on Nantucket. It's a field of seed scallops equal to the size of about 35 football fields, she said.
35 football fields.
35 football fields. That's a lot. That's a lot of baby scallops.
A lot of scallops. Yeah.
But, you know, given a lot can change over the course of a year, you know, storms and any other number of things. But even if half of those scallops mature for harvest, that would be about 10,000 or more bushels that would be available for next year. And that's more than the total number harvested in Nantucket and Mattaquette harbors on Nantucket annually over the last few years. Riley, who runs the town's shellfish hatchery, is working with a team of her employees to take samples from the seed bed to try and define its parameters and its health. And she's also trying to come up with a management plan to oversee the bed over the winter months to make sure that as much of the seed as possible is able to grow into adult scallops to harvest next season. Like I said, this season is not turning out too well. Good thing for the fishermen is the prices are going up, but they're not even able to get their limits many days of the bushels of scallops they're allowed to take in on any given day. So if you're on Nantucket and you want to get some scallops, you better get them soon and put them in the freezer because it doesn't look like it's going to be a very long season.
So let me ask you, this is found out in Mattaquette, as you say, but they also seed Nantucket Harbor, but they haven't seen anything comparable. Is that right?
Correct. They haven't seen anything comparable. They're hoping that maybe they've just missed a couple of spots. They weren't aware of this huge bed in Mattaquette either until they sort of came across it. But it doesn't really look like those seeding efforts are paying off in Nantucket Harbor yet the same way they seem to have paid off in Mattaquette Harbor.
I want to ask you about another story in the paper. A couple of projects in the downtown area are raising concerns with neighbors. They have to do mostly with possible renovation and expansion for restaurants.
They do. Both the former Woodbox Inn and Restaurant and the former Brotherhood of Thieves Restaurant downtown and just outside downtown have recently met with quite a bit of neighborhood opposition. And the new owners of both are rethinking their proposals. Blue Flag Partners, which owns the Woodbox property, bought it earlier this year, has decided not to bring its renovation expansion plan before the planning board on Monday, as they'd originally hoped to do, until they get some more feedback on the project from neighbors and preservationists. There's been a lot of negative feedback so far from both neighbors, members of the downtown, residents of the downtown, and preservationists as well, who say that the proposed expansion and renovation is too large and too detailed and not in keeping with the closely built houses and narrow lanes of the neighborhood, which dates back to the early 1700s. The building itself is 312 years old and still retains many of its original or close to original historic features. The new owners of the Brotherhood as well have decided to scale back their plan, and this is an outside plan. They want to put up, they wanted to put an outside patio in, or expand the outside patio, actually, to create what has been called a mini Cisco Brewers after the popular brewery, winery, and distillery in the middle of the island. But they've scaled that back now after getting quite a bit of pushback as well. Their new proposal, which the planning board is going to look at on Monday, reduces the guest capacity on the patio to 133 from the 195 they originally wanted, and limits the outdoor service area to about 2,700 square feet instead of the 3,400 square feet they wanted. There is an outside patio at the property right now that's currently permitted for 108 guests, so it's still an increase over what's there now if that goes through with the current proposal.
That's Josh Balling checking in with us from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. One of the greatest challenges facing our region is housing. On the islands, this crisis is even more acute. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with a fresh look at this. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, the Times has a special report called Voices on the Housing Crisis. It's really an opportunity to look at this problem from a number of different angles, a lot of very telling personal experiences here. Give us a sense of the shape and scope of this.
Yeah, so we've done a couple of these special sections. First one was on racism, and the second one was on the pandemic. And housing, of course, is another huge issue facing the island and facing all of southeastern Massachusetts. But it's been particularly exacerbated by the pandemic. Folks who had seasonal homes have moved into their homes year-round, cutting the number of winter rentals. And then there are, other challenges like short-term rentals, which have become so lucrative for folks that also cuts into the amount of housing on the island. So we took a look at it. And these are really intended to be voices from people experiencing it from many different perspectives. We have an elderly person who would like to stay on the island, but that has become more difficult. We have young people who have come to the island to, you know, seek job opportunities and then find themselves, you know, with no place to live, not even rent, or in situations you just don't want to be in, renting a room or in some cases sharing a room with someone else. So it's a particularly acute problem on the island, but there is hope. You know, this we wanted to make sure we included some stories of hope. So we have a lottery winner, one of the people who got an affordable housing. A housing lottery winner. Yes. And was able to stay on the island with her family, and some of her other family has moved back as a result. And so there are inspiring stories as well. And all of this comes as there's a big push to have a 2% transfer fee approved by the state legislature that would then be used to fund a housing bank, and money from the housing bank could help people with down payments or rents or some of the other issues that are facing young people, older people, and people in the middle. Philippe Jordy, who works for Island Housing Trust, one of the affordable housing developers on the island, often talks about the missing middle. And those are the folks like firefighters, police mm-hmm. officers, newspaper reporters, who can't afford to live on the island with the pretty good salaries that they make, but it's just not enough because of the prices being driven way up.
I think one of the great things about this kind of report for us as readers of the paper is that we talk about the issue, and there's so much to talk about in terms of policy, why it's here, but to actually kind of remind ourselves of the people that this is really about. You do a wonderful job of casting a wide net here for these voices and really listening to them when you ask them about housing and what it means to their lives.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, this comes from, you know, having great sponsors and as well as a great ownership team of Peter and Barbara Oberfest, who are willing to devote a section of the newspaper to an important issue like this. And we'll have more of these to come in the months ahead.
Let me ask you about another thing going on at the Times. It's the Martha's Vineyard Times is sponsoring a movie showing on the island. Perhaps no one should be surprised. It's a documentary about a small town newspaper.
Yeah, this is a really cool little documentary. I did get to see a preview of it, and it's about a newspaper in Storm Lake, Iowa. And the editor there, Art Cullen, won a Pulitzer Prize. Big deal for a small newspaper like the Storm Lake Times. And he did it by writing really powerful editorials about how the meatpacking industry was affecting the community there, not unlike Martha's Vineyard, even though it is all the way out in Iowa. It is facing challenges with housing, and it's facing challenges with immigration and the many issues that brings. This is a really good movie where we were inspired to invite them by listening to a podcast, the Fresh Air podcast. And so we're really excited about this opportunity. We weren't able to bring Art Cullen and the people who made the movie to the island, but there is a Zoom that we've done that people will be able to see afterwards, a little conversation about the industry and how challenged the newspaper industry is right now. We don't often tell that story enough, I don't think. Lots of businesses are having difficulty, but the news industry is really hurting right now, and we need our readers to know that and hopefully become partners with us in helping us keep moving forward and bringing them the news that we do.
It's George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Take care.
Next week, Boston, that big city to our north, will swear in its new mayor. Earlier this month, Michelle Wu became the city's first woman of color elected to the office. Morning Edition's Patrick Flannery spoke with our CAI State House reporter Mike Dean about what it could mean and more from Beacon Hill. Here's their conversation.
Mike, Kim Janey bids farewell this week as Michelle Wu is set to become Boston's new mayor. That happens on Tuesday. What does Janey's 8-month legacy look like as she leaves? And what can we now expect from Michelle Wu over the next couple of months?
Oh, Janey definitely left a mark as the first female and the first person of color to serve as Boston mayor. This is, on an acting basis. And, of course, Michelle Wu then being elected kind of fills those same slots. And that definitely has had an impact on the image of Boston. To replace a Marty Walsh with a Kim Janey really says a lot about how far the city has come, especially then when it's confirmed by the election of someone like Michelle Wu. Throughout those 8 months, she ran her own campaign for mayor that was unsuccessful, but she's dealt with the end of the pandemic, bringing Boston schools back online, transportation, a lot of the same kind of municipal issues that all the cities and towns in Massachusetts have dealt with. And she's also had some unique problems, like, the ongoing crisis at Mass and Cass. She moved to get rid of the camps that had been put up around that, as far as drug users are down in the Newmarket area of the city. She made that call. She's dealt with an ongoing problems with the police department, and especially with the commissioner of police kind of being suspended and then removed immediately when she took office. So it's been an active 8 months for Janey, and she definitely has a brief but significant legacy.
Remapping Massachusetts for political representation isn't over yet. Redistricting, as we know, happens once a decade. It gives the chance to set boundaries for a voice on Beacon Hill. So, Mike, what are state lawmakers doing when it comes to Fall River and New Bedford? We know that the mayors of those cities don't even agree on whether they should share a district. So, big picture, what's ahead for redistricting?
Yeah, the Fall River issue really does come down to two different political philosophies. Is it better to have both cities that are similar, Fall River, New Bedford, in a kind of South Coast urban core, is it better to have them represented by one person in Congress where the two cities can have an outsized voice and really influence this single congressperson? Or is it better to have the two cities in two different districts so that they have two congresspeople within the delegation fighting for the needs of the South Coast? And you can take it either way, and a lot of people with a lot more familiarity with how D.C. works kind of do argue both sides of that. A lot of activists, though, do want the two to be unified in one district. They want it to be in that South Shore, Cape Cod, Bill Keating district, unified in there, so that they can have a larger voice to Keating and to whoever succeeds him, and have a larger electoral role in electing who succeeds him. So there are a lot of people, we heard from a lot of different witnesses, all local lawmakers, municipal officials, like you mentioned, saying, no, we like having two because they like being able to call up two congresspeople instead of just the one who might have more of attention being paid to the South Coast. So the lawmakers are going to have to approve maps eventually. This is the hearing phase and the public hearing phase. They will either change the maps to alter them or they will keep them the way they are. We don't really know yet what the committee and then what the full legislature is going to do on this, the last bit of redistricting that they have to do before the end of the year.
And that is CAI's State House reporter Mike D in there speaking with CAI Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery. You are listening to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Trunker. Dolphins, turtles, and seals, oh my, all of them in the news this week. CAI's Eve Zukoff reported on rescue and research efforts about all three this week. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Let's start with sea turtles. This week you reported that New England aquarium scientists say that they've developed what they call a revolutionary new way to monitor threatened and endangered sea turtles over long periods of time. Explain this for us.
Right. Okay, so excuse me. Well, aquarium scientists say that they have successfully surgically implanted acoustic tags in sea turtles. And they're calling it revolutionary because for years, when the 1,000-odd sea turtles strand each year on Massachusetts beaches, rescuers have rehabilitated them and then released them back into the wild, often from West Dennis Beach. And to study their release sometimes, scientists would take these $5,000 satellite tags and affix them to the shells of the sea turtles. But those tags only last about 3 months in many cases. The turtles kind of outgrow them sometimes. They fall off. So what these researchers just did is they put the sea turtles under and surgically implanted these acoustic tags just underneath their skin, kind of right by their hips. And it's like an easy pass system, the way this acoustic tag works. So every time a turtle passes by this acoustic receiver in the water, it pings. And I will say these tags are not new. They're used in lots of other animals, tuna, sturgeon, and the huge benefit is that they cost about $400 and last for 3 years, which is just a massive change. And incredibly, these scientists say they've gotten some data back and they've found their three test subjects have been thriving in the wild, pinging more than 100 times these acoustic receivers, which is a really encouraging sign that they might be able to tag many more sea turtles going forward.
Well, tell us a little bit more about how it seems that these test subjects are doing out there in the wild.
Oh, you mean Popeye, Captain Kool-Aid, Glossy Ibis, and Peanut. Yeah, they're doing really well. Thank you for asking. So Peanut was detected on inshore and offshore receivers in the eastern part of Nantucket Sound. Captain Kool-Aid and Glossy Ibis were detected on inshore receivers off Ocoee, Hyannis Harbor, Bass River. Now, I will say Popeye hasn't been detected yet, but the scientists say they're actually not worried about that. It's very possible that sea turtle has just bypassed the receivers and swam straight out of Nantucket Sound when it was released.
Okay, well, you also reported on the effort to rescue stranded dolphins from Cape Cod beaches. Very different animal than a sea turtle, requires different tools. How's that happening?
Well, okay, so the folks at the International Fund for Animal Welfare, better known as IFAW, that is their specialty, is rescuing dolphins and seals. They actually rescue 264 stranded seals and dolphins each year on average now. It used to be a lot lower. And mainly they're doing common, Atlantic whiteside, and bottlenose dolphins. And to do that this winter season, IFAW is actually using this relatively new dolphin transport truck that they call Moby. And it's outfitted with these soft blue mats and this mini clinic. And so that when they pull a dolphin off a beach that's been on land a long time, they can treat it for muscle cramps and shock, sometimes even pneumonia and other conditions, as they move it from, say, a beach in Wellfleet to a release point in Provincetown. And this truck is pretty amazing. I walked through it. They actually used to use a converted landscaping truck, which was less ideal. It was a little bit of a bumpier ride for the dolphins. And this one is one of a kind. It's allowed the researchers to transport, or the rescuers, excuse me, to transport up to 9 dolphins at one time.
And how are dolphins responding to being picked up and put in a truck?
It really depends. Sometimes they're really calm. They just kind of flutter their tails. Other times, some will kind of thrash about. About 30% will vocalize. That's often the mother-calf pairs. So they're usually put next to each other by the rescuers. And I will say, when they're really agitated, I loved this part, the team developed this system that allows them to fold some of the foam mats up in the back of the truck into a kind of a tent formation so that a 200-pound dolphin can kind of rest inside of it, and it simulates more of that dark underwater environment that they're used to. It's kind of a calm area.
Listeners will know that you're our environmental reporter. You spend a lot of time looking at climate change impacts. You've done a lot of deep reporting on the proposed machine gun range out at Joint Base Cape Cod. Is this like the upside of all of this, is that you get to report on dolphins and turtles and things like that?
I hoped you wouldn't realize that you're paying me this week to do this kind of work. Please let me keep playing with these sea animals, Steve.
I remember one of your very first stories was about an enormous loggerhead turtle released to the wild.
That's right. 1,000-pound loggerhead sea turtle, largest ever rescued and rehabilitated. Her name was Munchkin. Thank you.
That is CAI's environment reporter Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Sam Houghton, and Daniel Ackerman. Spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle and Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. We checked in with Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and CAI's Patrick Flannery and Mike Dean talked all about all the news from the State House and, of course, CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program, the cool hand on the control board that keeps the whole show from overheating. Thanks, Dan. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.